G'day, welcome back to English History Fact and Fiction, episode the 234th, Prince Henry Fred. My name's Dick Newman, let's get on with it. Bit of Baroque music there. That was written in 1603 by Carlo Gesualdo, O Vos Omnes, part of the Catholic liturgy, and very nicely sung there by the National Youth Choir of Australia at Brisvegas, St. John's Cathedral, Brisvegas. O all you who walk on by the road, pay attention and see if there be any sorrow like my sorrow. Yeah, and Carlo might have something to be sorry about, given that he recently murdered his missus and a lover. They found him in bed together, so he killed them. When the authorities came in, I said, "Crikey, what a mess. What went on here?" He said, "Well, I really wanted to make sure they were dead, so he really made a mess of these two people." But it's Italy in 1603, where if you find your missus and a lover in bed together, killing them, well, that's just part of life, so no charges. And he went on to write more songs about holy stuff. Nice for him. But it's not about psycho killer Baroque composers. It's about a recap. And last week I was all over the shop of the timeline. But we saw that apart from stuffing up in religion, Jim stuffed up in Parliament too. We got to beat Jim's new boyfriend, Robert Carr, who's gone from nobody to Earl, like that's ever gone well in the past. I suppose Henry managed it with Charles Brandon. There is that. Then we got the back story of the popular one of the family, Prince Henry Fred, who we left having made his first step into secret foreign policy, which was a cock-up. It's all about Venice taking Big Papa Pope's Venetian land, so Spain wants to build up Venice while Henri IV of France wants to support the Venetians in belting the Spanish, and the Protestant states worry that Spain and the Germanic states will amalgamate, giving us another super sausage emperor. So German Protestant states want Jim to come belting with them, and yeah, it's getting all very itchy. I feel a 30-year war special coming on, but not today. Let's just make sure we've got Henry Fred where we need him first. And look, it occurs to me that I've had to bring Cecil back to life, haven't I? I killed him off too early in the episode, sorry about that, but he won't mind that he's alive again for a bit. Actually, Henry Fred is pretty much up to date. Well, he's not up to Cecil's death. That fiddling with foreign policy was a signal to Jim that his little boy had grown up. Henry Fred's palace will change from school to princely court, or collegiate court, really. That's a princely court where uni-type learning goes on. Plus, gentlemen will learn how to privy council or get generalship for dummies, and most of all, how to suck up to a king in waiting. One of the teachers, James Cleland, will make lots of gay references about guys winning the love of Henry Fred, like Hercules loved Hylas and Achilles loved Patroclus and Alexander the Great loved Dephaestion. Is he encouraging a bit of boy-boy banging? Because it surely sounds that way with those references. The tutors are also talking up reformation, not of religion, but government, military, legal, pretty much everything. We need to get a bit more modern, they reckon. The future King Henry Fred to lead England halfway to heaven is the idea. King Jim's not so keen. He wants Henry Fred to be like himself, Jim, one of Plato's philosopher kings, jammed to the gills with book learning. Jim sees himself as the smartest guy in Europe, and he should emerge as an international leader who the other kings will come to for guidance. Well, I don't think so. Henry Fred, then, having a bit of a court where guys can try to be his bestie, is attracting lots of his own hangers-oners. The ones he likes are the military types, guys who want to go bashing somebody foreign, and that also isn't sitting well with the King's policy of peace, love and lentils. Worse, Henry Fred is bringing in the old boys of battles with their maps and campaign stories. Plus, he gets stories about contemporaries like Maurice of Nassau, who will become the Prince of Orange, who also took some lowland states and got them to the point of defeating the might of Spain. Now, Maurice of Nassau's secret was to not make mistakes, and observe the mistakes of his enemies. Said it before, if you don't have a good role model to follow, then observe the mistakes of your bad role model and just do something different. It works. Maurice was also in early on what is now standard practice. Get your commanders to write a diary of each day's events, then we all chat about it over tea and scones. What went right, what went wrong, what should we do next, that type of stuff. Just to make it easier for Henry Fred, here comes Maurice's brand new book on military tactics with a nice new formation. Henry Fred and his guys will start drilling daily in that brand new military training yard he's built. Yeah, they want to do this new formation. Maurice will hear about it, and in comes another copy of the book, personally signed by the author. The stuff that Henry Fred was already reading was the top shelf of the military stuff. He's getting the best advice. The lads, of course, will also be doing tons of the horsey training. They would always be in the elite, and that's the cavalry. Worse for King Jim is that Kitty Charles is starting to emulate his big brother and coming out also to learn the horsey stuff. The collegiate court has turned into a military academy. More and more guys join the court of Henry Fred. On top of that, King Jim with his new boyfriend Robert Carr is spending half the year outside London, leaving those guys who pore over bits of international news and information without adult supervision. Ambassadors can't see Jim if he isn't there, and we need someone to authorise shit. They'll start turning more and more to Henry Fred. He's becoming a de facto regent, but he's still only a teenager. In comes the biggie. Spain is too broke to fight the lowlands and wants peace. Robert Cecil will come in for talks with Henry Fred. Spain wants to be acknowledged as the ruler of the lowlands and for the lowlanders to accept their Catholic stuff. Well, that seems like a pretty fucking stupid condition to put in a proposed treaty, given that that's what the fighting's been about for 30 years. Lowlanders, of course, will say, no way. Henri IV will chip in with, why not just make it a long truce? Robert Cecil will tell Henry Fred that the truce is the way to go, and believe it or not, we'd have peace in Europe for a minute or two. But Maurice of Nassau doesn't want a bit of it. We're just about to kick Spanish ass and we need to keep going. We need to just belt them a bit more to force them into a treaty that gives us everything we want. Robert Cecil will give Henry Fred solid advice. Don't worry about what you think is the right thing. Just endorse the truce idea when any foreigners turn up. King Jim will soon work out he's on a good thing. All the excitable and overly chatty guys will be going to his son's court, leaving him alone to do just the big stuff and remotely. Trouble is, his lad will need a building of magnificence, and Jones, of course, is broke. Oh, great, say the money guys. Prince Henry Fred had kept taking more and more people in, so his existing court's expenses have gone through the roof. King Jim will write to remind the Lord Treasurer that money is the nerves and sinews of war. Look at the Spanish. They know how to fund the military stuff. Treasurer will write back saying, hey, that cash comes from America, and we don't have a handy America to bring in piles of cash. Henry Fred at least gets it. He needs to learn about money. So he'll be off to London, the Merchant Tailors Company. They should know about money. It'll be a big welcome, of course, and the deal will be that they can come to his court to see what he has to offer in books, soldiers, sailors, inventors, laboratories, etc., and they can teach him about filling his empty money bin. While he's there, Robert Cecil can show him the new exchange. Now, we already had the Royal Exchange in Betty's time, England's first shopping mall. It's done so well, Robert Cecil has opened another one, the new exchange. And Henry Fred will see firsthand the benefits of trade and lots of value on display. The royals, of course, will get some super good stuff, all for free. Henry Fred was interested in science-type stuff. Our brainiac Thomas Harriot is now his tutor, and Harriot's made all sorts of groundbreaking discoveries. Henry Fred right now has him working on cannon trajectory. You and I might not think that's the best use of a top scientist. Henry Fred has also worked out that a telescope will help map the stars for better navigation. There will be plenty of entrepreneurs there seeking investments to fund their proposals. Henry Fred, though, is looking out the window at Robert Cecil's new house, or palace, really. That's when he'll twig that while his dad is handing out cash, Cecil is raking it in from patronage and the handing out of perks and positions. So, the Lord Treasurer will die, as we know, and we'll have Cecil in as the new Treasurer, with Henry Fred in for a cut. Off he goes to Cecil's palace for a look at a particular bit of magnificence, and there's a huge map of America. Henry Fred is onto that with the location of the Northwest Passage and Raleigh's ideas of colonisation. The mutually beneficial ideas of colonisation. Of course, Henry Fred has a great source of information on Raleigh in Thomas Harriot. 1606, and it's a charter for the Virginia Company, with most of the guys in that being Henry Fred's men. It says that the colonials over in Virginia will be run by a council, but all decisions are to be made by Dickhead Jim 1 and 6. Oh, we've got this problem in Virginia and we need to ask Jim for a decision. The reply should be here in 6 or 7 months. Yeah, the Virginia Company may not mention that bit to the colonials, so they'll be off thinking that they're going to be autonomous. Off go 150 settlers and we get to Jamestown. At least they don't have to displace any locals, and that, ladies and gentlemen, was because the locals thought it was a shithole. Not suitable for anything, but lots of mosquitoes. Yeah, it's mosquito paradise. It's nicely defensible, though, but we've also arrived during a drought, so more than a few settlers will be doing some dying. For any fans of Virginia, Cape Henry is named after our own Henry Fred, as is the Henry River. After getting news that the settlers are there, Henry Fred will become an investor. The Spanish, of course, are unhappy. They still think they own the whole continent. Still, there's peace in Europe, so our wealthy elite are thinking of tourism. Get in there quick, lads. There's a 30-year war coming your way. England has absolutely hit the Renaissance by now, so instead of wanting to go to the baby Jesus stuff in the Holy Lands, we want to go to Florence and all the magnificent palaces on the way. Yeah, we've hit the Renaissance, but really we should be looking at the Baroque, which has started quite a few years ago in Europe. Oh well, we just aren't trendsetters in England. Bring on the 1960s. Right now, it's going to be tourism, and Henry Fred's mates will be off to Europe. This is also a top time for our spies to be out and operating with easy access to borders. Henry's BFF, John Harrington, will be one of those going, and it's not a quick trip. About 3 years is what you expect. Harrington will write lots of stuff for Henry. Not political espionage, although politics are included, but letting Henry Fred know who's doing what. He'll get into Florence just in time for the wedding of Cosimo de' Medici and Maria Magdalena von Habsburg. He'll send an illustrated letter to Henry Fred with a note saying, "Why aren't you or Mum or Dad writing back?" "Well, John, it's because your letters aren't getting through. Catholics are intercepting them." Fair enough, I guess. John's letters hinted that he had big political news. Henry Fred's other mates, Devereux's son and Cecil's son, are writing pretty bland, dull and boring stuff. Another of Henry Fred's mates, though, wrote some stuff I found interesting for the Language and Observations. Here he is, talking about the sea crossing to Calais. "I varnished the exterior parts of the ship with the excremental ebullitions of my tumultuous stomach, as if desiring to satiate the gormandizing portions of the hungry haddocks." You see, this is the age of Shakespeare, and we want big and unusual words, and even better if we can invent a word. You might be surprised by some words that were invented by Shakespeare. No hanky-panky in the bedroom until Shakespeare came up with, well, bedroom. That's the word he gave us, bedroom. We can't have "we are the champions of the world" for queen until Shakespeare came up with champion. He gave us eyeball, swagger, well-bred, yeah, lots of words, and it's the fashion. Henry Fred's mate also wrote about being amazed to see a nun. Yeah, remember we don't have those in England anymore. Frenchies use some sort of stick with three prongs on it to eat. They carry a pole with shade on top to stop the rain hitting you. This guy will come up with the new word for that thing, umbrella. In Spanish-run Milan, he'll visit Castello Sforza, making plenty of notes on its defences, and ask lots of questions until the Spanish threaten him with the slammer. He can let us know that the Milanese hate their Spanish masters. Off to Venice for some research, which he tells us is to find out why Venetian prostitutes are considered the best in the world. Enjoy that, mate. This may not actually be that hard. The prostitutes he's talking about are courtesans. Extremely well-dressed, educated, singers of songs, nicely perfumed, that sort of stuff. He says if she can't get you off by playing the lute and singing, she'll get you off with her rhetorical tongue. That gave the lads back home a bit of a laugh. So she's got you and I'll be back to her place where you see all manner of pleasing objects. Back he goes through Switzerland and down the Rhine, and nice timing, mate. It's all about to be smashed up bigly. But right now it's all peaceful and the crops are growing and the towns are thriving on activity and trade. Back through the lowlands, meeting Morris of Nassau and visiting the Schneckenschnaz, built by top mercenary Martin Schneck as the most formidable stronghold in Europe. Our man can draft a design of it. It's a marvel of modern engineering. We may have a truce, but both sides have their hard men in place, so our guy will just wander through the lines as an innocent tourist, marking out routes for something like, well, I don't know, a mighty hero English prince to come riding in. And we might leave Henry Fred there, but we'll come back to him because he's a welcome relief in between talking about that fucking Jim 1 and 6. A bit more of that holy music. Maybe he was composing that while he was frenziedly killing his wife and a lover. Said the guy got off with absolutely no charges. Might help you to know that he was an heir to a principality. He'll be prince in a couple of years, in fact. So, yeah, prince, murderer, composer. One of those is his job, I guess, and the other two would be hobbies. But our King Jim may be best known as the authoriser of our brand new magic book in English. So that's where I want to go. I'll tell you a story. I don't know if it's that good a story. About biblical scholar Richard Clarke. The King Jim version lasts even now for old people like me. In our more modern times, of course, lots of people have decided to publish their version. Even with Jim's, there'll be problems. A marvellous printing press requires guys to faithfully set up the type exactly, which doesn't always happen. So there'll be plenty of errors creep into editions over the years. But back to the story. Okay, Richard Clarke, Doctor of Theology, and currently in a shitty job, preachifying in the back blocks. We know from earlier episodes these guys are underpaid and no general pay rise coming in. The best bet is if churchy types would give you an extra job or something. Richard scored a gig on the Bible Project, but it doesn't really pay that well. Plus, he's got to move out of the back blocks to Westminster, and that's going to cost. Moving to London, that'll cost you. He can't really expect another paying gig because, like lots of churchy types, he's been considered as naughty in the past. Yeah, hung around with separatists. But here comes Bishop Bancroft to save the day, making him one of the six preachers at Canterbury. So that's going well then, but Bishop Bancroft wants to know about Clark's mate, Ben Kemp. Oh dear. Yeah, Clark's got to admit that he's a Puritan and worse, bit of a separatist. Not that much of an admission, really. Kemp had done 3 years in the slammer for that. The bishop will let Clark know that after a self-imposed exile, or really 7 years of working overseas for his dad in the Levant Company, Kemp is back in England. But what he wants, he wants Clark to go and stay with Kemp to be a filthy snitch. Now, there's no subterfuge really here. Ben Kemp knows that Bishop Bancroft is aware that Richard Clarke is hanging out with Ben Kemp. It's a bit awkward, though. He's living with the whole Kemp family, and they like Richard. He'd been a mentor to Ben at uni and visited him in the slammer when he was in for being a Puritan separatist type. The Kemp family also have some form. Distant past, but Ben's great-great-granddad had been set on fire for the Lollardy thing. The family's been under a bit of a strain for years and years because they had bits of Lollard Bible hidden in the ceiling. As for the authorities, they only have to wait till Sundays to confirm who's what. Ben Kemp doesn't want to go to the Anglican magic show. It's not the true magic show for him. Dad will pull out the honour thy mother and father thing. If you're under my roof, you come to my magic show. No, 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 baby Jesus said, don't recognise any king or priest or prophet or lord. Just recognise baby Jesus is the rule. Ben ain't going, so we'll all say, oh no, he couldn't come because he was crook as a dog. Now Richard Clarke can pop into Westminster for his first meeting with his group. I think we mentioned this, there's groups of guys working together that get a section of the magic book. Richard's group has Genesis to Kings, the real old stuff, first 12 books. Each guy to work alone, amending what we've got, existing translations, or go back to direct translation from the Hebrew. One day a week we'll meet, compare and revise our work, sift the truth from the untruth, then we should have passages to reflect God's perfection. That done, bring on the feast. We are at Westminster after all, so the tucker's pretty good for Richard Clarke. Ben's family, meantime, are trying to talk Ben into going back overseas. That's a way safer option for him than England. Ben will crack the shits and be off to Scooby-Doo to be with his congregation. His congregation's a bit at risk. There's 60 of them, and that's a pretty large mob for secret meetings. Now, their meeting place, in case you want to go, my dear listener, is Gainsborough Hall, owned by Sir William Hickman, who was cool with the separatists. Back to Richard Clarke and the essential work of translating the old magic book. Here we are at Noah looking to build his ark. Translations into English had him building it out of pine. Yeah, that seemed unlikely, say our translators, so they go back to the Hebrew. It's built out of something called gopher wood. Nobody's heard of it. In modern times, Christians have decided it must be cypress, but for our churchy tops, they're worrying about what type of wood the mythical ark was built from. Perhaps they should have been thinking about how the fuck did a 500-year-old guy build a ship about 1.5 lengths of a football field? And it's got to be 4 stories high with a roof on top of that. Nah, it doesn't seem likely. Okay. Back to our Hebrew word, and we'll look all over the magic book to find another reference. But there's just the one, and we can't translate that to pine like the previous guys, because we all know it certainly wasn't pine. So even today, my dear listener, if you read the true word of God, as said in the magic book, you will read that Noah built the ark from gopher wood, even though nobody knows what it is. That's sorted, and what an important task that was. Okay. On to the rest of the instructions for a DIY ark. Apart from working on the totally serious problem like what gopher wood is, Richard is being told by his mates that he's a dickhead for associating with Ben Kemp again. And Bishop Bancroft is putting the heat on. He wants hard evidence and names of these dangerous separatists. Richard just wants to bring Ben Kemp back to the current true faith, the real one. Bishop Bancroft will also get Dean Andrews to put the heavies on Richard to keep the pressure to get Kemp. Now, Ben Kemp will come back to London for his sister's betrothal. Good news. He will dance. Not a vaulter, but a pavane. Still, for a Puritan, that's pretty un-Puritan-like behaviour. Richard can report this development to the Dean, and in exchange, the Dean will give Richard a small political lesson. Betty had liked to keep some of the bits of the magic book nicely vague, which the Dean thought was very smart. Jim 1 and 6 wants to remove all doubt. Yeah, well, try translating Hebrew, Jim, and tell us what gopher wood is. How this happens, my dear listener, is you take your Hebrew sentence, then translate each word separately, some words being plain as day, but others might mean this or that. So you put in whatever number of possible words it could be, then you just try various combinations until you get a sentence that at least kind of makes sense, or in some cases may support the message you want to get out to the mob. Richard can start working on the Book of Ruth. That's his favourite of the old magic books. He liked the Miles Coverdale translation, which was back in Tom Cromwell's time. Trouble is, that translation has errors. And here I am struggling with this because, I don't know, it just seems trivial to me. Should it read Groped About Him or Caught Hold? Does it say, Spread thy wings over thy handmaiden, or spread therefore the wing of thy garment over thy handmaid? Or should it say, Spread thy wings over the handmaid? I don't know. Why not just say, Ruth snuck into Boaz's bed for a damn good rogering? So long as we are precise on things like Ephesians, Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands, then the world's a good place for that, isn't it? Richard could see that Ben won't be coming back to the current true religion, so we'll pressure Ben to go overseas. But Ben doesn't want to go. Luke 6:37, Judge not, and ye shall not be judged. Condemn not, and ye shall not be condemned. Forgive, and you shall be forgiven. Unless you're Bishop Bancroft stalking your prey, Ben Kemp. Or in fact, right now, a Jesuit priest who's been judged, condemned, and executed. Yeah, we judged him. The point being, other translators are having their input into Richard talking down the Puritans and worse, the separatists. Some are saying you're risking your career by associating with Kemp, and others are saying you need to get Kemp hanged. Must have been a bit tough on Richard. One of the translators pushing for a hanging was a rather rough type. He was into booze and women, but he was needed because he was a brilliant translator, and of course 100% in on the current true religion. But he's nowhere near the pious behaviour of Ben Kemp. Big test for Kemp. His sister is now to be married in a church, oh dear. An Anglican church, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. For a separatist, going to an Anglican magic show, even a wedding, will send you straight to hell. No ifs, no buts. The God of love and baby Jesus simply cannot forgive that shit. Richard will suggest Ben just hang out at the doorway. Then you can see, but you don't have to go in past that invisible line that says anyone stepping over this line goes to hell. Totally safe outside that invisible line, watching the magic show from out there. I should tell you that Ben Kemp had been married himself. Wife and baby died in childbirth while he was in the slammer, but the point is, she insisted it would be a church wedding, so Ben caved in on that. So surely he's going to hell anyway. What's another wedding here or there? Worse for Ben Kemp, his sister's now married, so his dad will tell him that the will is changing so that Ben's new brother-in-law will get the business, the house and pretty much everything. Dad is investing in his hopefully soon-to-be grandson. Ben no longer represents the future of the family. Ben will be back off to his congregation and tutoring job. Now, you might say, well, Ben might have got remarried, but no, he said he's not going to get remarried because he knows it puts his wife at risk down to his religious views. Richard, meantime, has moved past Genesis and on to Exodus. God tells Moses, you are to lead my chosen people. Oh, I'm unworthy, says Moses. Can you find somebody else to do it? No, the magic book in use had said this. But Moses said, my Lord, send who thou wilt send. Wrong. Our lads will go with. And he said, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by thy hand of him whom thou wilt send. Much better for the poetry, but it misses out the I am unworthy. And King Jim is thinking our translators are unworthy. Bishop Bancroft says they need to speed up the process. Oh, no way, say our lads. This is the holy book. You have to struggle with each and every word. It's only been a year. News in that a rector in the Midlands has been nabbed. Refused the prayer book, refused the surplice, wouldn't kneel for the bread without yeast, and the slug of house bread. Yeah, hardened criminal there, my dear listener. The translator team wants to know if Richard knows this guy. That'll be an ode. But surely you would be mates with your dear friend Ben Camp. Puritans hang together like flies on a turd. Direct quote there. Puritans hang together like a flies on a turd. Okay, says Bishop Bancroft. Give us an update on Kemp. Nothing to report, says Richard. No matter, says Bancroft. We'll get to the rector's congregation soon enough and then we'll have a lot of them. But we'll cop a break when Catesby and Co. try their blowing up stuff and fail. Then we can suddenly all remember it's the filthy Catholics we hate. Great. The Puritans can cop a break for a minute. But not Richard. Bancroft hasn't forgotten Ben Camp. The translator team, though, know that if the explosion had gone ahead, the building they work in would have gone with them in it. Still, it's about peace and security in England, which is threatened by all non-conformity in religion. That will be the consensus view. Catholics, Puritans and separatists like Ben Kemp are all a threat. Back to translating, and we're struggling over the world, ain't Anne? Is it wickedly, or murmuring, or complaining? Very important stuff, my dear listener. The Jews complaining about God is wicked, so it should be complaining, but the point is, God hears the complaining, and Moses doesn't, so surely it should be murmuring. Let's take a vote. And when the people complained, it displeased the Lord. Ah, that's a great message for common smellies. When the people complain, it displeases the Lord. Yeah, complaining's bad. Let's move on to something meaty. Deuteronomy, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloni Adonai Echad. Oh, yeah, I hope no Jews listen to that. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is Lord only. Now, Coverdale had made it, the Lord our God is one Lord only. Tricky, because this is kind of around about the time where the Jews stopped being polytheists to become monotheists. Trickier, because we wanted to cover the one is three and three is one thingy. And that's tricky, because you're to worship God above all others, but at the same time worship baby Jesus and the Holy Spirit as much as God. Oh, that one is three and three is one thing is coming back to bite us on the bum. For the Jews, it was about the combining of the Elohim, or gods, into just one God. And this bit of Deuteronomy is their daily prayer forever. We'll be going with, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. All this holy stuff is well and good, but for Richard, as a person of note in his translator job, it will be go and watch the gunpowder plotters have their dicks and balls cut off, guts out, and then get chopped into little bits. Yeah, he's got to watch it, poor bugger. That's a handy reminder of what could happen to his mate Ben if Richard dobs him in. Maybe not, maybe just to hang him if he's lucky, but it's still nasty, doesn't matter what. Frustrating because God has offered Ben no end of opportunities to live safely overseas and retain his beliefs. He can do whatever he fucking likes over in the lowlands. Not everybody can walk into the family business in Holland where you can do the separatist stuff without a care in the world. Ben Kemp could go there tomorrow. So, what's the silly bugger thinking? An epiphany for Richard. He just needs Ben to understand that God's will is for him to go and live in Holland. Even better, you might think, is that Ben is friendly with the family there, which happens to have a hot widow who is hot for Ben. He could get married again, live happily ever after. But no, his work in England is too important. And illegal, of course. Hot widow's dad had tried to talk him into staying, but Ben had said, no, look, it's in the scriptures. And ye shall be hated of all men for my name. But he that endures to the end, he shall be saved. Yeah. Now, the dad knew his stuff too, and of course there's always a contradictory answer in the magic book. And when they persecute you in this city, flee to another. Yeah. But, nah, says Ben, God has plans for me because I'm special. Now the news is out. Following the gunpowder plot, the Archie of York is ramping up a bit of heresy hunting. And come the Archie's hard men to arrest Ben Kemp, but he'll be off, yeah, on his fastest horsey. Wherever can he go? London's about it for Ben. For me, it would have been the nearest water Uber and over to that hot widow. Fugitive Ben has gone to his sister's house, but it won't stay secret, and Richard will get to know. Richard will want to have one more go at convincing Ben to go overseas. That won't go well. Ben sees Richard as the enemy. But he can see the writing on the wall, so he's going to head off to the Archie of York to turn himself in. He won't get that far before he's arrested. Into the not-nice slammer for Ben. Richard's the first to get the story, so he can give the family the unhappy news and be tossed out. Yeah, tossed out of home. Ben can do some very unhappy time in the slammer, then be out smelling way worse than he did when he went in. And he's lost a lot of weight. Any happy news from the family? Yeah, your dad's dying. Ben wants to go to London, but he's too weak. He needs time to recover. Richard, having been tossed out of the house, is in shitty lodgings in London, and it's all how the mighty are fallen or how the mighty are overthrown. Look, overthrown sounds a tiny bit like rebellion, so we better go with how the mighty are fallen. Ben will be off to London as soon as he can. Middle of winter, he's not fully fit, but he wants to see his dear old dad. And dear old dad has been calling for his dear lad. In he goes, and dear old dad, who is really on death's doorstep, will say, "I left just enough cash for you to go to Holland. Promise me you'll go to Holland and that hot widow who's got a thing for you. And, oh, yeah, nice Dutch tarts and freedom of religion." "Nah," says Ben, "can't promise that." "Promise me, you little turd, so I can die happy," says Dad. "Oh, all right. I swear to go and live happily ever after, tasting the widowly delights of that hot chick." And dear old Dad can go off to his heavenly reward. The family do not like Richard. They blame him for Ben's incarceration. That wasn't his fault. Ben broke the law. Richard didn't make Ben break the law, and Richard had nothing to do with dobbing him in. Okay, but they think Richard dobbed him in. Richard didn't dob him in. The family are annoyed about government policy, and Richard is handy to be angry at. Richard will go to dear old Dad's funeral. Are you thinking a stupid move? Richard, though, has another mission. There is one family member who is not unhappy with Richard, not by a long shot. Ben's cousin Alice. So Richard has decided the funeral is the right place to ask Ben to agree that Richard can marry Ben's cousin Alice. Oddly enough, Ben will have a "what would baby Jesus do" moment and say, "Oh, sure." "Thanks," says Richard, "and by the way, I didn't betray you, and I swear that by almighty God." Ben will be back off to his congregation, and these guys can now see that England is not the place to be. Yeah, finally, when the authorities are on to them. They're making plans to leave, and Ben's up for it. The whole congregation wants to sneak off to Holland, and the authorities have just made it hard to leave the country. Ben's cousin, Richard's girlfriend, will ask Richard to help. Oh dear. He's actually very unpopular among the churchy types because he keeps hanging around with the Kemps. Good news though, the congregation have found a guy with a ship who will sneak them out. Let us translate. "And after the earthquake came fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a small, still voice." Yeah, shouldn't it be a small, still sound? Well, we translated that word previously. We didn't come up with voice or sound. We came up with thunder that time. Hang on, I'll phone heaven and check. No, they will go with voice after some nice debate. It's a tough time for Richard, who is getting a combination of pressure to dob in Ben Kemp and the cold shoulder because he failed to dob in Ben Kemp. So he will dob in Ben Kemp. As the psalm says, "Yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, has lifted up his heel against me." Richard has spilled the beans. The congregation are looking to get out of the country, so surely it's just the easiest thing to let them go, he'll say. We can be free of them. "Oh, no, Richard," says Bishop Bancroft, "that is not for us to decide. It's the law." The congregation had sold their assets, and now we can get on the road, walking to the coast, carrying everything they own. 2-day walk, then down to the beach at night for the secret rendezvous with the secret water Uber. And where the fuck is that secret water Uber? There's no iPhone to follow its progress, so it's just waiting, waiting, waiting. And we're getting worried because if the sun comes up, we'll all be found on the beach, a big mob of us. That's pretty suspicious. But oh, look over there, a column of somebody holding torches heading our way. Yes, it's the bishop's men come to make some arrests. And of course, when arresting a nice bunch of traitors, it's a good policy to check under the ladies' bras and knickers to see if they have anything hidden away. And of course, we need to check the luggage for contraband. Ben will protest, go to a lady's aid, and get a nice hard beating, like a really hard beating. Richard has nearly finished his translating Kings 2, which is rather important to King Jim 1 and 6. King Josiah was wandering around the temple when he said, "Oh, look here, it's the lost book of our people," and, well, let's have the real words. "For great is the wrath of the Lord that is kindled against us, because our fathers have not obeyed the words of this book," which they did, man, "to do according unto all that which is written therein for us." Whoops, my bad. The King Jim version is, "The wrath of the Lord that is kindled against us, because our fathers have not hearkened unto the words of this book, to do according unto which is written concerning us." Admit it, you didn't even hear the difference. Who cares? The big deal with this is that King Josiah, who discovered, in air quotes, that book Deuteronomy, used it to do that just one God Yahweh thingy, allowing Josiah to get conformity into his rule. Yeah, just like King Jim 1 and 6 wants. Plus, for Josiah, his dad had been a polytheist and was assassinated for that. Just FYI, Josiah will start a war against Egypt. Bad move. And it will be he who hides the Ark of the Covenant for Indiana Jones to discover in the movies. But really, the real Ark of the Covenant's location will be revealed to us all when we get to the apocalypse, which should be any day now. The Egyptians will kill Josiah. There you go, that's tidied him up. Richard, of course, has an attack of the guilt sand, fair enough. If he'd studied ethics rather than magic, he would see that he's actively participated in an unethical law. It'll be worse when he finds out the whole congregation has been nabbed. Men, women and children all in the filthy slammer. Richard will be off to Lincoln's slammer to visit Ben, take him a magic book and some food. Good news, women and kiddies released pending their trial. Bad news, that the beating that Ben copped is turning out to be fatal. Ben's in a filthy slammer and he's dying. On his deathbed then, he will forgive Richard the dobber. But will Richard ever forgive Richard? Maybe not. That's a terrible story, I know. No empathy for Ben Kemp, who had plenty of opportunity to go to Holland and live happily ever after with the hot widow and do his religion however he wanted to. No empathy for Richard Clark, who acted unethically, dobbing in his mate to the authorities when he knew it would go badly. The thing with separatists like Kemp is their creed kicks off with something like, "Baby Jesus is my Lord, my King and my Priest." It's DIY religion, which does seem to be what Baby Jesus advocated, but cutting out the kings and bishops means you're putting yourself outside organised society. You've got no obligation to follow the laws of the land and, therefore, dangerous. The job, though, is done with a newly translated magic book, the King Jim's Authorised Version, and we all think we've got the ultimate word of God. But have we? I can't see it. The Hebrew Bible has 24 books. The early Christians thought that was a repeating yarn and added another 25, giving us 49 books. Those extra books were a mix of Hebrew, Aramaic and Greek. The Latin church didn't like three of those, so they dropped it back to 46. Protestants liked even less and dropped it back to 39. We have all those different languages, making it difficult to know which one is the original. Are we translating to English from the original language, or are we translating a translation? Does any of this matter? It surely does if the guys in charge of government want to insert religion into policy. But for me, the Old Testament is like a work of historical fiction. That is, it's a history of the Jews that follows events like who killed who and battles that were fought, but with plenty of made-up stuff in it. All translations are dodgy, as Erasmus found out with John 1. In the beginning there was the Word. The first writings of the New Testament were written in Greek. Makes it easier so. Well, there's Greek and there's Greek. we don't all speak the same Greek. So this stuff was written in Koine Greek, the Greek of the people knocked over by Alexander the Great. Back to John 1, in the beginning there was the Word. That's a literal translation, except logos, the word in English, means a number of letters with a vowel in it. But in Greek, the logos is much, much more. We need to turn to our pre-Socratic philosopher Heraclitus. It can mean lots of things to do with speech, like reason and discourse, but it's also something divine, meaning a principle of order and knowledge. Really then, the translation for me in this case should not be literal. It should keep the Greek word and be, in the beginning there was the Logos. Then we have to work out what the Logos is all about. That wouldn't happen, because in doing that we'd have to start examining philosophy and reason and logic. And they are the enemies of religion.
War after war and rumors of war from the east. There's a rumbling in the ground and they're talking about the beast. Good mother's cry calls the rivers run high with the blood of too many sons. Some people say peace is on the way, but the worst is still to come. 'Cause the prophets wrote about it, and Jesus spoke about it, and John got to take a look. And he told us what he saw, and it's easy to see. It's going by the book. It's going by the book.
And that book that Johnny Cash is singing about is the King Jim Bible. The translators have met King Jim's brief. Make it conform to the ecclesiology of the Church of England and reflect the episcopal structure of the church. That is, it's got to be about the church and the hierarchy of the church, with Jim, of course, at the head. It was important to wipe out Puritan readings of the magic book, which were about the congregation, the people, not the church, not the organisation. That in itself led to mistranslation. Any time the magic book referenced congregation, our translators would just put in church. Bottom line is that it's the best translation so far. In our modern times, there are hundreds of different English language Bibles. Up to you to figure out which one of those is the true word of God. Now, here's a letter into Jim. Who could it be from? Oh, Dr. John Dee. What does he want? Well, his reputation remains in tatters and he feels slandered. He wants Jim to grant him royal protection and to be put on trial so he can clear his name. Fortunately for Dr. Dee, Jim gave zero fucks about him. I say fortunately because, don't forget, Jim's into persecuting guys like occultists and setting them on fire. Dr. Dee, though, is stuffed. He's been outcast by both the court and the mob, and of course it'll get worse. His birthday in 1594 had seen his son die. Then in 1601 another son died. That plague that slowed down King Jim's entrance to London saw his missus and three daughters dead. A few people still use his astrology, but he can't charge much. He's a bit of a nobody now. People won't pay. He'll live out his life in depression, dying aged 81 in 1608. He'd been planning a trip to Germany because the Archangel Raphael had told him to go there. Dr. D will be buried at Mortlake Church. Now, 10 years later, a local antiques dealer will find his papers, which included the records of his angelic chats. 1659, and these will be published in a book. A true and faithful relation of what passed for many years between Dr. John Dee, a mathematician of great fame in Queen Elizabeth and King James, their reigns, and some spirits. Yeah, shitty title, isn't it? But it'll be a smash hit, which included a bit of a bio on Dr. Dee, saying he hadn't been chatting to angels at all. No, sadly he'd been chatting to demons in a clever disguise. And thus endeth the tale of Dr. John Dee, Weirdo. Now let's get away from magic books and angels and into philosophy with Prince Henry Fred. His mate Harrington is on one of those European tourist jaunts and he's landed in Venice. Now, you might recall, Venice has tossed out the Jesuits and taken the Pope's Venetian toys away, with Philip of Spain saying they're going to come and give the Venetians a good kicking over that, and Henri of France saying Frenchies will come in and support Venice. Venice, of course, is a republic, run by oligarchs rather than kings. Yeah, no difference to common smellies. Henry Fred and Harrington were fans of the old Roman guy, Tacitus, and why wouldn't you be? Tacitus was pretty bloody smart. This is advanced thinking for Henry Fred and Harrington. Here's Henry Fred writing to Harrington. I, who am in all kinds of polite learning a mere novice, and who have made scarce any advances from the depths of ignorance, never dared look into Tacitus, whom I have heard represented by everyone as a writer of admirable sagacity. However, since you challenge me in the field, I am determined to follow you, though with a slow pace. Yeah, shows what he knows when he says everybody says Tacitus is wise. King Jim 1 and 6 might be a tiny bit appalled with Henry Fred reading that stuff. Jim's all about the divine rights of kings, which is more than a bit tyrannical, where Tacitus is giving out helpful hints on how to oppose or resist a tyrant. Tacitus also gives out a rather good description of corruption and its effects, and we in England have been living with corruption for a very long time. We actually like it. Well, the rich people do. Tacitus had this rather famous father-in-law, Agricola. If you happen to go to Bath in England, you'll find a statue of Agricola there. He served under Paulinus in Britain, and 20 years later, he went back to be governor of Britain. Henry Fred will start reading stuff about an heir to the big chair can resist flattery and corruption. That's what got Caligula assassinated and Nero suiciding. Now that will lead him to Tacitus writing about how marvellous Agricola was with self-discipline and virtue. Agricola did it by following Seneca and the Stoics. Now, I know I bag Stoicism every chance I get as being a philosophy for boring old white men, but being a boring old white man myself now has led me to re-examining the Stoics to see what's in it for me. That's led me to practice a bit of Stoicism, and that's led to my happiness levels increasing. So, yeah, no more bagging the Stoics for me. But even a fanboy of Stoicism will tell you, don't get too carried away with it. It could lead you to having an overly inflated opinion of yourself, and worse, lead you to civil disobedience. Henry Fred and Harrington will be looking to marry Stoicism to Renaissance thinking, and soon discover they've been beaten to the punch. John Calvin had referred to it, and before you know it, a Flemish guy had come up with Neo-Stoicism to marry Stoicism to religion. Yeah, that's better. It's more about righteous resistance to the government rather than civil disobedience. And once again, just in time, in comes Shakespeare with Coriolanus. Coriolanus is a Stoic, and the entire state is at risk because he is rigid in his thinking. See, my dear listener, some humans will take whatever, religion, philosophy, politics, and just be totally rigid in their thinking, which can lead to bad stuff. Coriolanus thinks it's the principle of the thing, while everything around him is just turning to absolute shit. Yeah, he's winning on the principle, but it's killing Rome. We humans survived on adaptability, but lots of us forget that. Henry Fred, though, is not worried at all about civil disobedience. He will sit on the big chair in due course, but he certainly has taken the point about power corrupts. His young guys will now start obsessing about how they can get corruption out of the government. Yeah, let us know if you ever figure that out, guys. Tacitus certainly didn't have the answer, but his suggestion is what we kind of have. Only kind of. You need a wise and benevolent king, advised by confident and vocal privy council and supported by an elected parliament with all men of virtue and honour. Fair enough, that is a very good system. It's just that our king isn't wise and benevolent, our privy council is full of sycophants, and, yeah, don't go looking for honour and virtue in parliament. You won't find it. Now, what's King Jim 1 and 6 got to say about Henry Fred's new hobby? Stoicism is insensible stupidity. Yeah, Jim's not a fan. All he sees is that it's anti his type of rule, and in that he's dead right. Too late, Jim. Henry Fried's court has become the centre of neo-Stoic thinking in England. Sounds like we're in Germany. Here we are. John Harrington has finished inspecting the boudoirs of the ladies of Venice and is now in Heidelberg. Oh, I do hope he's feeding himself plenty of strudels served by cheeky strudel wenches. Now, this is Calvinist headquarters, but who cares about religion right now? I should mention that Heidelberg is also the capital of the area we call the Palatinate, meaning the ruler can rule his patch independently of the Emperor Sausage. He still owes his allegiance to the Emperor Sausage, but he can rule independently. Now, the Empire itself holds diets, that is, meetings of the big swinging dicks. One had happened just recently, and led by Fred IV of the Palatinate, the Protestant big dicks had all walked out of the diet. Now, what's that all about, you ask? Well, yeah, it is religion. I don't know why I said, yeah, forget religion. No, it's about religion. Donaworth is a town where they had freedom of religion. By the early 1600s, there were just 16 Catholic households left out of a population of 4,000. And those 16 households of Catholics wanted to be dicks about it, doing stuff like marching around with saints' images and relics and banners and singing baby Jesus songs. Protestant majority said, fuck those guys, and started attacking them. Now, Max of Bavaria was a militant Catholic, and he persuaded the Sausage Emperor to issue an edict denying Donaueschorf Protestants of their property rights. Oh, that should fix things. No, Max and the Emperor, no, it won't fix it. So the Emperor authorised that Max could send 6,000 hard men to sort those Protestant fuckers out. In he comes, removing Protestant magistrates, smashing up infrastructure and saying all churches will need to be Catholic. Now, Protestants across the Empire were outraged and will ask the Emperor if he's lost his copy of the Treaty of Augsburg, which recognised Protestant rights. Oh, that's right, says the Emperor, I forgot that. Hang on, I shall knock out some updated legislation to revoke that treaty and tell Protestants to all become Catholic again. The dear sweet darling Jesuits can help make it all better by financing hard men to wander around Protestant lands enforcing the new anti-Protestant deal. And now the Emperor will just totally ban Calvinism. Protestant big dicks will form the Protestant Union to demand their rights back. We want Henri IV and Jim 1 and 6 to sign up to that club. No way, says Jim. Look, it's peace, love and lentils for me. In come the best and brightest German ambassadors with lots of strudel, but it won't do any good. Europe has finally gotten just a little bit of peace, and Jim thinks it should stay that way. The heir to the Palatinate and Henry Fred were pen pals, so the Germans thought they might try him. Yeah, King Jim won't allow it. So we've got Venice pissing off the Catholics and the Empress Sausage pissing off the Protestants, and yeah, this could all turn very nasty very soon. Back to Henry Fred, who's read his Tacitus, and he will see Robert Carr as a scheming parasite who threatened the reputation of his glorious dear old dad. Queen Anne is on board with that assessment. 1607, and Carr is knighted and made a gentleman of the bedchamber, attending to Jim's most intimate needs. Robert Carr has the best access to the king, even better than Prince Henry Fred. Jim has by now developed the rather bad habit of looking at Robert Carr while speaking to other people. It doesn't matter who he's talking to, he'll look at Robert. Queen Anne and Henry Fred are used to Jim having his favourite boys, but this Carr thing is going to another level. The flattering of the king, though, is totally endemic. A couple of English courtiers, experienced guys, will advise Henry Fred on it. Now, they give him some pretty solid advice, but at the same time, they're actually flattering him themselves. They can't help it. And the king gets it. He wrote in that book to Henry Fred, "Be at war with your own inward flatterer. Be careful to prefer none but only for their worthiness, but specially choose honest, diligent, mean but responsible men." Solid advice that Jim isn't taking himself. Be specially free of that filthy vice of flattery, the pest of all princes and the rack of republics. It's worse, of course. Don't be effeminate in your clothes or perfuming, preening or such like, and don't make a fool of yourself in disguising or wearing your hair long or growing your nails. Such accoutrements are excrements of nature. Now all that's a description of Robert Carr, effeminate, perfume, preening. Carr will then get Raleigh's house with Raleigh's widow and kiddie tossed out into the cold, cold snow. No, not quite that bad. His widow and kiddie will get compensation, but not what you might call fair compensation. And Jim will have to borrow the money to pay for that at a time when he's supposed to be getting money in. Henry Fred will go into bat for Raleigh, but that won't do any good. Even worse, Queen Anne has stopped talking to Jim altogether, so Jim is asking Henry Fred to be the go-between. Oh, that's nasty. Jim's got a rather sharp message for Anne. Now, Henry Fred, though, will work out the problem. Queen Anne was writing to Jim, but he wasn't replying. That's terribly rude. But this is Henry Fred, who will look into the matter further before reporting back to Jim. Somebody, and now is a good time to look at Robert Carr, somebody is intercepting the Queen's letters and Jim isn't getting them. Well, Robert Carr is the King's secretary, so sure, we're all thinking Carr. Henry Fred will also tell Jim he didn't deliver that rather sharp message, just in case Queen Anne decided to go back to her old ways, arguing loudly with Jim, disrupting the court and getting involved in politics. Now, Henry Fred will want to move into Whitehall so he can keep an eye on Robert Carr. He will ask Herbert of Pembroke and Risley of Southampton to vacate their apartment so that he can move in. No way, they both say. Henry Fred will just send in some guys to move them out. Henry Fred sees them as parasites too. The court, of course, is amused, and Henry Fred is getting his loyal guys in to form the Henry Fred faction. Now, to get into the Henry Fred faction, you need to prove yourself. Flattery will get you nowhere. Doing service to the prince will work. So I think we might leave this on the 19th of February 1609. Prince Henry's just turned 15, and he's an adult ready to spring into action. A little bit of the Knight's Galliard there. Nice and jolly to get us into some historical fiction. And over the last few days, I knocked over 5 books by a guy, K.M. Ashman, the Brotherhood series. Now, I've had a crack at K.M. Ashman's books before and haven't managed to finish them. These are boys' own adventures, and I just felt like that because reading those William Gold novels is a little bit of work for the reader, and I thought I just need something quick and easy, the sort of stuff you could read on the bus on the way to work. So, look, K.M. Ashman does kind of follow the history reasonably well of the that period of the Crusades. It's set a bit before and then a bit after of where we were with the marvellous Ridley Scott movie Kingdom of Heaven. So we've got Saladin in there, that's marvellous. He just has a few too many characters for me, and some of his characters do really fucking dumb things that just make you want to scream. So there's, we'll go to a guy, make a deal, the guy will renege on the deal and rip us off, and then we'll immediately make another deal with him. And, oddly enough, he'll rip us off again. Who'd have thought that? So stuff like that gets a bit frustrating, but apart from that, if you want something to read on the bus and you're into a bit of the Crusaders type stuff, K.M. Ashman, the Brotherhood series. I think you can get these things free from Amazon if you're looking for something for nothing. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And coming up on the playlist this week was Melody Gardot for me. So how about we go out with Melody Gardot and Your Heart Is As Black As Night. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
Heart is as black as night. Your lips may be sweet, such that I can't compete, but your heart is as black as night. I don't know why you came along at such a perfect time, but if I let you hang around, I'm bound to lose my mind, 'cause your hands may be strong, but the feet